Good afternoon, Hong Kong. It's an incredibly hot day outside. I think we're in the 14th day of a massive heat wave in May. Yesterday, a temperature of 38.6 degrees was recorded in a farmland in the New Territories, which is the second highest temperature recorded in Hong Kong ever. So I think we can all agree that climate change is having an effect on us. Welcome to A Zero Waste Journey live on air. I'm Sonali Figueres from Green Queen. Why should you care about the temperature and why is it related to food waste? Well, something that a lot of people might not realize is that most of our food waste, and we'll get into the numbers later, go into our landfills, which are basically almost full. And when they're sitting in our landfills, they then produce methane, which is a type of greenhouse gas that is 20 times worse than CO2, which is what we spend most of our time worrying about. So that has a direct impact on our very, very high temperatures and what we're experiencing right now in May, which shouldn't be happening. So that's why you should care today out of all the days, because you can actually feel it outside. I'm really excited about episode 4 of our podcast journey. As you know, this podcast is dedicated to zero waste, and today's episode is called Tackling Food Waste in Asia's Most Gluttonous City. Food waste is a topic that has sort of gone a little bit out of vogue lately, with zero waste and plastic free becoming a bigger deal, but I think it's really important to talk about it because, as I like to say, everything's related. Nothing should be looked at with blinkers on, so we're going to dive right in. Before I talk to you about the food waste situation worldwide, I'd like to introduce my co-host, Regina Larco, founder and host of Hashtag Impact, my favorite podcast in Hong Kong. And she's going to introduce our amazing panel. So welcome and welcome,
Thank
Regina.
Thank you for having me, Sonali. It's so exciting to go on air again live for episode 4 of this Zero Waste Journey, where I have already learned so much. So big thanks to you, Sonali, for even letting me be part of this. And I'm so thrilled to be sitting in a room today with super inspiring women who are leading the discussion here in Hong Kong, and globally for that matter, on food waste and security. We have Janice Leung Hayes here today with us. For her efforts towards food sustainability, she was named Inspiring Homegrown Entrepreneur in the inaugural Women of Hope Awards. Today, we welcome her in her capacity as founder of Honestly Green and top food journalist. She says, "I believe that the less interested, less invested we are in the act of selecting what we buy, the less producers will care about what they are making and selling." Janice, in a nutshell, what have you set out to do with Honestly Green?
So, thanks for having me. The first thought before I started Honestly Green, it was really that I'd met farmers in Hong Kong. No one would ever think that we had farmers, like especially 6-7 years ago. And the fact that I met them and thought, well, isn't it then natural to buy from them can't we kind of create this economy again? Because Hong Kong basically has had no agriculture since the 1960s. So that was the initial thought, and then it's gone into all sorts of things. Like I've ended up starting farmers markets, ended up working with online platforms, trying to get more people to buy local, all sorts of things. And we're still trying to promote more and more local consumption. Literally, there's very few cities in the world where you can harvest in the morning and get your produce by the afternoon in your house, and you can be munching on it. I think that's amazing, and we really need to really consider that in a city that imports so much food.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, and raise awareness for that as possible.
Yes,
and
of course.
And that there are places where you can get those fresh vegetables and greens. Yes. We also welcome Dr. Daisy Tam. She's assistant professor at the Hong Kong Baptist University. Daisy is passionate to put food on your agenda. Looking at food security and food waste, she says, "We are facing an invisible crisis that is everyone's problem. Everyone. Before we dig deeper, maybe can you just fill us in what you're working on right now to raise awareness for this pressing issue? Welcome, Daisy.
Hi, thanks very much for having me. I think this is, I've been continuously working on this problem for many years now, and the awareness, I think, has been raised within a certain community, but I think we need to push it to the next level where we can not only wait on individuals to take on the responsibility, but also collectively, where can we push this further? The idea that it's everyone's problem, I think it's important. It's not only the people who are interested in the environment that is concerned. It's not only the people who are interested in health that is concerned. It's not only the poor that has to be concerned. Everyone who lives in the city and eats has to be concerned about this. So, that's I think in general what I'm still continuing to work on it, and I'm trying to sort of push it to the next level to involve more people and also to bring it to the level of the city.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Due to a last minute emergency, we're going to have to go ahead without Liz Thomas, the founder of Food Savior. We will mention what she does later, but we're going to keep going with these two amazing ladies who I think for many, many years, I mean, anybody that does any research in food waste in Hong Kong will find these two names. Janice and Daisy are at the forefront of this, and they've been raising awareness about this for many years. So it's a real honor to have them. Also super exciting to have an all-women panel again.
Yay.
I have made a little bit of a commitment on this podcast to shine a light on women. Because why not? Men get lots of light, and you know, we have incredible ladies doing incredible things. So thank you for that introduction, ladies and Regina. I'm going to introduce kind of food waste, and I really want everyone who's listening to take a moment to absorb the couple of figures I'm going to share. So while this episode is going to be about Hong Kong, which has a frightening and embarrassing food waste crisis. In the world, I'd like to share with people that from the latest figures, 850 million people go hungry every year. That's almost a billion people. So it's a huge, huge, huge part of our population. Next to that, you've got one third, so or 33% and up of food that is wasted every year. So just 850 million people don't have enough to eat. Okay, and that's the people going hungry. Let's add on, then there's people who are food insecure. So that's maybe another 500 million. And 35% of the food that is produced is wasted. So this is a disaster of just unimaginable proportions. And it's every time I say these numbers and I read these numbers, I have to take a moment and just, I feel so terrible, as I'm sure anyone listening would. What's even crazier for everybody with a business mind is that the wasted food comes at a cost of 750 billion US dollars a year. So we've got people who can't eat because there's no food. We've got food that we're throwing away, and it's costing us money. So I mean, we want to talk about human ingenuity. This is more like human stupidity, for sure. Some things that are worth knowing in the developed countries like Europe and most of North America, we're not just wasting food, we're overproducing food to the tune of 3 or 4 times more than we need. Because one of the beginning problems of food waste is overproduction of food. Okay, so we're making too much food. We also have to remember that we're not just making food for humans, we're making food for animals, because we have this incredible need to eat so much meat and eat more animals, which is a whole other problem. And so we're creating waste, food waste, by producing food for them. Then, as I mentioned in the beginning part of this episode, we are creating greenhouse gas emissions because the food is ending up in landfills. And that creates methane. Methane is the same greenhouse gas that cows produce. So, you know, we've got huge movements pushing veganism because, you know, cows are such huge polluters, but no one is talking about the food waste that we're creating every day that is also causing a huge, huge percentage of the methane in our air. Last year there was a food waste sustainability index that came out, one of the first by The Economist as a part of a nonprofit project that they're doing. And they ranked a few countries. Now, again, this is not every country in the world, because of course, one of the hardest things about food waste is that it's very difficult to find the data. Most countries do not keep the data or track the data, and if you do, everyone's got their own kind of different way to track it. So very difficult to do this project. So yes, it is very limited. I think less than 40 countries were ranked, but the winner was by far France. France only wastes 1.8% of its food. The worst performer was Saudi Arabia. 427 kilos per person are wasted every year. They are by far, by factors of 10, 20 times the worst. Saudi Arabia is, the UAE is pretty bad, the United Arab Emirates, and in Asia, Indonesia fares pretty badly. In terms of the best, you've got France, you've got South Korea, you've got Australia, they're doing really well. So that's what's really happening. But I think now let's dive into our city. As many of you know, we are one of the most foodie obsessed cities in the world. I think we have the most number of food bloggers in the world. We have the best expression ever. I'm going to butcher the Cantonese language, but it's my favorite Cantonese expression, 5K16, which is the camera eats first. So people here love to go out to eat. We love to eat. We love to talk about what we're eating. We love to take photos of what we're eating. We also have one of the highest numbers of restaurants per capita. Depending on which figure you go with, it's one restaurant for every 300 or 600 people, which is very high. So we've got a lot of restaurants, we eat a lot of food, but we also score incredibly badly for food waste. And so I think let's have Dr. Professor Daisy Tan, one of the foremost experts in the world on food waste in Hong Kong, tell us more about Hong Kong specifically. What are the numbers? What's the situation? Where are we at here?
Please just call me Daisy. That was a fantastic introduction of what the situation is globally, and I think Hong Kong mirrors a lot of that illogic logic in our food system. So this idea that we are importing, we do not produce anymore in Hong Kong, we import most of the food that we eat, over 90% or even some at 100% import rate. For example, beef, we import 100% beef. But in general, importing 90-95% of the food we eat and throwing out 3,600 or 4,000, I think, tons of it a day now. It's been increasing over the past couple of years. While 20% of the population face food insecurity. I mean, that's the kind of illogic logic that we are working with and that we are faced with. I think this is a kind of... It's, for me, it's something very interesting to talk about and do research on, but I don't actually think of it as a waste problem. For me, it's a food problem. And I think that shift in thinking about whether it's a waste problem or a food problem changes the kind of questions that we ask. So I always put the idea of food surplus food rescue and all this kind of reducing waste at source actions and awareness campaigns in the context of how do we make our food system better, more sustainable, more equitable. So I look at it as food, and I think that's also the idea that we're all working with. Hong Kong being so rich, I think it's also a problem because we are often, I mean, even today, while we are very... a certain population or a certain group of us are aware of these kind of problems, but talking about the idea of food security in Hong Kong seemed like a joke because we are so rich. I mean, who would ever think that there are people in Hong Kong who do not eat three times a day, who do not have enough nutrition, who are undernourished? And this population are more vulnerable than others when And I think that's wonderful that you introduced today's topic with the weather in the face of climate change, because I do think in the long run that food security is something that we need to worry about, especially for us who live in cities who are completely dependent on everyone else to grow our everyday needs, right? So we are completely vulnerable to global economics, commodity prices, but also climate change. When there is a flood in a particular in the region, when there is a heat wave and it affects food supply, prices will go up. And we've sensed that before. I mean, we have experienced it already. So I do think that this is something we need to think about in the wider context of sustainable urban development, but it's food, not waste.
I love that. I mean, I think that's really getting to the crux. And speaking of food, not waste, how do we eat the food? And I think this is where our resident food journalist, Janice, can really talk to us more about, you know, what are the issues currently in terms of, as a city where we do go out to eat a lot, you chronicle a lot of that. You know, yes, there are our chefs making a difference, and I want to talk about that later, but what are the issues today in terms of how we buy our food and how we eat our food?
Well, one of the strange thing happened one day at the markets, at one of the farmers markets I run. So at the end of the day, some of the farmers had some leftover vegetables, and they gave them to me, and there was way too much for me to have in a week, which is when they probably start to go bad. So I saw some friends, and I wanted to give like some vegetables to these friends. They all said no, and they were waving their arms frantically like I was giving them, you know, it's like a hot potato, basically. It's like, do not give me any. And you know what the problem is? None of them cook. So they don't know what to do with an eggplant. Like, you know, and I think that is actually, you know, Hong Kong has so many restaurants, and it's so easy to go out to eat that people are scared of produce. Like, they don't know what to, like, they're scared because they're scared to bring it home like it's some disease.
So we don't have an ugly produce problem. Yeah. We have a scary produce problem.
So then, like, I work a lot with farmers, and they're obviously trying to sell their produce, and they're growing it. They're putting a lot of effort in growing it, but actually getting people to buy it and also to cook enough so that they don't leave it to, you know, to die in their fridges is actually becoming an issue, which I didn't even realize until that incident. Because I cook, but I'm not a fancy cook at home. Like, I literally put things in the microwave. But, you know, just to think that people aren't doing that even is a really.
I remember when you launched the Taiping Shen market, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I mean, for years, people have been saying, "Oh, we don't have anything in mid levels. We don't have anything in Shangwan. We central something central."
Yeah.
So you got the farmers there,
yeah. and then very few people turned up, and we had to close down because it wasn't worth the farmers going all the way out there because they
would just stand there by themselves.
Yeah, they're out in Camden. I mean, within Hong Kong borders, but they're pretty far, and they need to cross a couple of tunnels to get to.
It's expensive for them to come.
They got to park, and sometimes if they can't find parking, they get a ticket, mm-hmm. and it just wasn't worth it. Mm-hmm. And to launch Taiping Shan Street, we tried a crowdfunding campaign because I thought, look, a great way to reduce food waste would be if everyone just bought whatever came out of the farms, if there were subscription boxes.
So it was already paid for.
It was already paid for. The farmers can do it sustainably. And also we could help reduce the waste at the farm level. Because a lot of times things get thrown away during harvest if they don't look good enough or if they don't, or if they think they're not going to sell enough of it, it just goes to waste. So I thought if we could get enough people to subscribe, mm-hmm. there were, I don't know, maybe 30 of them, 30 subscriptions on the crowdfunding campaign, and at least 28 of them were my friends. And one was my mother. So
oh, bless.
You know, just trying to get that off the ground and think, and getting people to kind of think in that way seemed very difficult. I think it's something in Hong Kong where really we do struggle with trying to communicate the importance of getting something directly from the farm to you and to streamline that distribution. Because a lot of that, you know, logic mm-hmm. is to do with distribution. We grow enough food, or we buy enough food in Hong Kong, but we don't distribute it properly, and that's why so much of it goes to waste, and so much of it, you know, is thrown away. So yeah, I mean, I can't even remember what the question was.
No, but it is how we eat, and the problem is that you've got, you know, the richer Hong Kongers who don't actually, not only do they not cook a lot, but they don't buy their food directly. And then this is always going to be a problem with sustainability of food, is if you're divorced from your food source and you're not the one who's making your food and need it and go in and get your food.
Yeah.
You know, we've got helpers, people have helpers. And then the more middle class and lower middle classes and poorer people, they often work terribly long hours. And a lot of times it's easier to just go down and get your cha siu fan, you know? It's $30 for that, for a meal. It's actually more expensive because of rising food import prices. It can be more expensive to cook your own food. So you've got, you know, people who struggle economically. This is an economic problem. I mean, we are now in a world where it's actually expensive to cook. You know, unlike in the US or in Europe, where it is actually cheaper still to cook in a lot of ways, here it's not.
Well, I mean, that's, if you look at the price of like a meal, sure, it looks like it's cheaper to eat out. But if you look at the quality of the food that they're using or the sourcing,
absolutely.
It's completely...
But, and how you're doing your math, and also energy costs and all of that. But at the end of the day, there are quite a few very cheap, very convenient. The other thing in Hong Kong is the convenience that, you know, we need to talk about. Everything's at your doorstep. I mean, this is why e-commerce has not really taken off here, because it's so prevalent. It's so easy to go everywhere. In most places, you have to drive 30 minutes, 40 minutes. So it's just easier to cook yourself an egg at home, you know. What's really interesting is that if you dig into the numbers in Hong Kong food waste, you realize that actually, so I think 70% of the waste that is food waste is actually consumer food waste. So it is the consumers that are throwing away the food. And then the other thing to note, which is very worrying, is that most of the waste going to landfills is food waste. So as Daisy said, the number is now close to 4,000 tons a day. I did some calculations, because we do have some incredible food banks and NGOs working to tackle this problem. So if anyone's paying attention, there are people like Food Angel, Tinshar Y Foundation, Food Link Foundation, Feeding Hong Kong. We actually had invited a couple of the founders from some of these organizations to come in. Unfortunately, they couldn't make it in today, but they do incredible work. But I just have nothing but love for what they do. But I do want to talk to you guys about numbers, because there is this kind of feeling like, oh, well, someone is taking care of this problem. And what these NGOs do, and they all do kind of a little bit of a similar job, which is they take the food surplus from businesses and food producers and restaurants. Everyone has a different kind of avenue of distribution. And then they repurpose the food to people in Hong Kong who are hungry. So it's tackling food waste. It's also tackling hunger and poverty and food insecurity. So Feeding Hong Kong has been around since 2011. And they have diverted 1,300 tons of food, which is about 3.6 tons per week. Food Angel, another one since 2011, also has rescued 4,614 tons of food, which is about 12.6 tons per week. Food Link Foundation, which has been around the longest since about 2001, quotes their number at 15 tons of food per week rescued, okay? So total, just those three are diverting and rescuing 31.2 tons per week, which sounds, you know, really good. Yeah, it turns out we're sending 800 tons per week to the landfill. So if you do the math, they're not even diverting 0.0013%. So not even 1%. So that's just, and this is not meant to take away from their incredible efforts. Actually, I hope it makes you get your checkbooks out if you're listening and give them a donation and go and volunteer and do some work. I mean, if you've ever volunteered and cooked meals, you see how incredibly organized they are, how well these organizations are run. It's amazing. But this is not even a drop in the bucket. I mean, this is like not even a scratch on the bucket. this is such a small number because our problem is so gargantuan. Daisy, I know you, in your TED Talk, you did mention that, you know, we need to help these organizations more, and you've done a lot of work looking into them. What do they need from us, these NGOs? And like, how, you know, do we need more in terms of, should more food banks be started? I mean, does it work?
I definitely think it works. I've worked with many of the organizations that you've mentioned, and I'm very interested in not just the amount of the volume, which is very important, but also what it is that they are repurposing.
Mm.
So I think it's fascinating to see some of the smaller district-based NGOs work with, I mean, the ones that you mentioned, the large ones as well, they do, but it's the fresh food versus the packaged food.
Right.
And so this is the kind of data that I've been collecting over the past 5 or 6 years, and looking at the amount of fresh food and packaged food that these NGOs are turning over, because it's also thinking about this food system in this particular arena through the whole process, right? So they are saving this, they are taking the surplus and saving it from going to the landfill, but it's also going to the beneficiaries, those who need low-income families, elderlies, and what kind of food do they need, and do they want, or do they prefer? And I think this is something that we need to also pay attention to. I'm a big fan of the work of food rescue NGOs, and I know a lot of the times they do struggle with the pressure to deliver volumes, precisely because they, funders or government, they want to see
the numbers,
the data, the numbers that seem to speak all. But when you are trying to shift tons of food, and when you're trying to shift this kind of volume, packaged food is way easier in terms of logistics and distribution. But packaged food often means processed food, chocolate cakes, you know. And to an elderly person who's suffering from diabetes, chocolate cake might not be the thing that they need, even though they might want it. Or, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables, on the other hand, are much more regular in their kind of in their surpluses, because fresh food, wet markets, for example, they generate a lot of this kind of everyday green healthy food, and these might be lesser in volume, so less sensational when we talk about it, but these are the things that is better for the beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think making that, pushing a little bit further and looking at the difference between the fresh and packaged food, the healthy staple food versus the non-healthy, non-staple food, I think that's one issue. And then the second is the logistics, right? Like you mentioned, Denise, like earlier in the distribution problem. In fact, a lot of the work that we are talking about, whether it is produce or is it food waste or is it restaurants, it's about logistics. It's about moving things from one place to another. And if that chain is not efficient or easy, then waste would appear. Then waste would be produced. And that's how that kind of logistic is also important. So in terms of volunteering for NGOs and or donating to NGOs, there are the individuals, which we can talk about maybe later. But I think for the donors, goodwill and thoughtful, giving them enough time to then turn over that volume of food is also important. So don't donate when it's already so close to the expiry date that the NGOs have nothing, they can't do anything about it. You know, give them time. If you already have an idea that this stock is not going to be sold in time in the next month, call them up, tell them you have this, and allow them to also work together. So I'm very interested in, for example, France having legislated against throwing away large amounts of food, like from large distribution, like supermarkets, for example. I'm very interested to know a little bit more about how that has shifted, and if support has been given to NGOs who then receive this back. You see, like I think policy change is very important, and you can see these very strong changes. But what happens further downstream?
Mm.
Are they supported? You know, can we get policy coherence, or is the action thought through? I think this is really important, and we can't know it unless we go on the ground. And I think that's where we all kind of agree. You know?
Absolutely. And then the other thing is the difference between processed and fresh food is one thing. I've spoken to a lot of food producers here who've had issues donating food because of regulation, because the government regulation doesn't allow certain types of food. Like somebody I know who makes pies, he's not able to donate his excess pies because they're not individually packaged, which is a whole other discussion about packaging waste and then regulatory waste. So Hong Kong does make it a little bit difficult to donate food.
Good Samaritan Act.
Well, and I think, yeah, so what is the Good Samaritan Act? Obama put it into practice. It's basically a law that prevents people from being brought to being charged against if something goes wrong, if they are operating in the greater good. It's a general law, but it's often applied to situations like this, and we don't have it in Hong Kong. So, you know, you have restaurants and supermarkets and retailers and producers who are just, they don't even want to get involved because they don't want to deal with the red tape. They don't want to be in violation. They don't want their restaurant license getting taken away. So again, you know, not thinking holistically about a problem that is actually affecting everyone, because the waste then is just ending up in the landfill. Right? Would you say that?
Yeah.
So in terms of chefs and retailers that you talk to, Janice, what do you see that is being done? I mean, there is some progress. You do write about some of the chefs.
Yeah, there is some progress. I mean, there's the, I think they're called the Zero Waste Restaurant Alliance. Mm-hmm. So a few restaurants have gone together to try and look at how to deal with the waste that comes out of the restaurants. So not just things like plastic and things like that, but also food waste. So if you look at a great example, is Grassroots Pantry, they now have a composter in their restaurant. So all the food waste actually goes in that machine, and it produces, I think, it becomes feed, pig feed, I think, after, like, once it's gone through the machine. So these sorts of, like, but this is their own initiative. This has nothing, there's no policy behind it. This is something that they've gotten together to do.
I think the homegrown food, the IHI guys also do that. Linguini Fini
has a compost machine. Yes, so they, yeah, so at the back of Linguini Fini, there's a food composter as well. And I think that kind of shows that it's possible, that even in small spaces like in Hong Kong, in small restaurants where people are so concerned about square footage, you can do that. Like, there are commercial machines that are not, you don't need a whole other facility. You can do that just in your own backyard, literally. It could be that a few restaurants could share one. And I think there are some restaurants now working to do that. I think that was the point of the alliance as well.
Wasn't it to collect all the waste to send it to
yes.
the farm? So I think Mana doesn't have a composter in
yeah.
there, the vegetarian
they
chain.
It and
but they
have
collect it.
Processed.
In a container,
yes.
And then they bring it to the farm.
There's several routes. One is farm composting, and another is machine composting that creates pig feed. So it depends on which. There are several outlets. One of the issues with thinking that you could all just take it to the farm is that there aren't enough farms in Hong Kong, and also they don't have enough square footage to deal with composting, because natural composting actually takes a lot of space, and also not to mention labor, and that's probably the bigger problem we have in Hong Kong. We don't have enough farmers. We have enough land, but not farmers. Mm-hmm. So that they aren't actually able to manually compost that much. That all that stuff that comes out of restaurants, for example, like there's no way all the farms would be drowning in compost. But another I think an interesting solution that we need to look at either as communities or as policy as a whole is that we need machines that can compost, and they're not that expensive. They're also not that, they don't have to be huge.
What do you mean when you say machines that can compost? Because I was at a festival a few weeks ago, the Conscious Festival,
yeah.
and I met somebody that's now selling reasonably well-sized composting machines. And then I said, okay, so great. If I could compost my waste, which is a huge problem in Hong Kong, is that we all produce a lot of food scrap waste.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those of us especially who love to cook.
Yeah.
And I've gotten a lot of my other waste down. I'm recycling the rest, but I don't have a composting facility in my building. So I said to her, okay, even if I buy this, which is expensive, and I commit to filling it, what happens after? How is this being collected?
Exactly.
As Daisy said, you know, what's happening downstream? And she said, well, we haven't figured that part yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Out that part yet. And I said, well, okay, well then I probably need to wait.
I mean, in home composting, so that was sort of a home composter, right? What I can
semi-small
see,
commercial,
well, yes, okay.
But not a pig feed machine.
So what I
converter.
Can see happening, which I would love, happening, is each tower or each residential kind of community can have one or two larger composters where people can just go downstairs, just like with your recycling, go downstairs with your waste. That waste then becomes, you can use it in soil almost right away. There might be like a couple weeks curing or something like that. And then look, we have so many of those planters in our podium gardens. You just use that in, and it just goes right back in. It's a no-brainer. And yet it is quite difficult to implement because there's so many hoops to cross, like to jump through, and like with management and all sorts of things.
Well, this is what we covered in the recycling episode, mm-hmm. is that it's really difficult because each building has a different management company and all the different actors have different incentives.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we come back to government regulation.
Yeah.
And if you look at what has worked in other countries, composting systems is 100% a part of the solution. What I find interesting, though, is there's countries. So South Korea, turns out, Korea's in the news a lot right now, thanks to a certain orange-haired fellow. But we do need to commend South Korea because South Korea, I actually did not know this. I'm embarrassed to say before doing this research, is maybe the most interesting country in terms of having tackled food waste, in terms of their regulation and how far they've gone. It's so far that they've gone, in 2005, they actually banned food waste from the landfills.
Wow.
Because now before that, they had done other things. And this is where you look at, in Taiwan, you have this, in Korea, in certain states in America, and that's the waste charges. So you pay for what you trash. And this doesn't just cover food waste, it covers all sections of waste, and it's a very fair system because it really means that consumers pay, businesses pay, you have to think about what you're doing a lot more. When we talked about this in the recycling episode with Paul and Edwin, we did talk about how the Hong Kong government had a waste incentive scheme, but it just hasn't gone anywhere. It does seem to work for food waste. The other thing is tax incentives, especially for businesses and retailers, that seems to work really well. And then things like in France, the mandated. So what France did a couple years ago, a year and a half ago, is they said supermarkets are no longer allowed to have food waste. They have to donate it to charities and NGOs or churches or wherever. So it it has to be in a condition that people can use it, as Daisy was talking about. So that's worked really well. And you now have a country where 1.8% of food is being wasted. That's an incredible number. I mean, really, it's hard to go below that. So the other thing that the Hong Kong government seemed very, very excited about but has not moved on is organic waste treatment facilities. So getting in all the waste and then kind of processing it, and then you can actually turn it into energy,
yeah.
And compost. So there's other things you can do with it other than just compost.
Yeah.
You guys are you know, as experts in the field, what do you think can work here? What's the most realistic? And should, if you were the government, you know, and you could decide, what, let's put something in today that can actually have an impact. Because organic waste treatment facilities, it's on the government website. They said since 2015, you know, they said we have plans in 2017 to build these. These have never gotten built. Okay, so that's not happening anytime soon because no developer wants to give up the land, I assume. What should we do? What's the best? I mean, the NGOs need more help, yes.
Yeah.
But what can the government say? I mean, should we? Is the incentive, Daisy, do you think the incentive scheme is where it's at?
I think that any sort of call to the government for action needs to go in parallel with something smaller that is more on the ground. So I'm a big fan of decentralized or community-based or neighborhood-based or district-based solutions as well. And the reason why I say this is because when we were brainstorming about the in preparation for the waste charges coming in and trying to sort of collect the food waste to go to this recycling center, one of the reasons we realized, and that was with the Environmental Protection Department, was that there's so many restaurants and they're concentrated in a lot of urban areas. How do you get the bin trucks to go in? You know, it's already causing a lot of congestion. I mean, the roads are already congested. I'm not saying they are the ones who will increase the congestion.
Like in Soho, you can't have a huge truck. Exactly. You need little vans.
Exactly. And then when you are actually dealing with food waste and food scraps, there is actually a lot of water in it. So in fact, if you think about it, if you don't treat that before, you are shifting a lot of weight, of which is water.
And using carbon emissions to do so.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that's a good point.
So the example that you gave, Janice, I also really liked, because I think that a lot of these things do not have to go very far. Like the smaller the kind of circulation, whether it is a community, whether it's a building or it's a particular residential
estate,
you know, there are. That's also the beauty of cities, is that it is so concentrated that if we were to push for a change, the infrastructure, the impact on infrastructure doesn't have to be very high because it's already so connected. So if we were to introduce a compost bin at the bottom of your building, if the garbage trucks could come regularly to pick that up, wouldn't that be easier? If the composting could be done on site, then start an urban farm, like grow the vegetables there. I mean, everyone's also
exactly
about that
everyone
too.
Would benefit from it. I mean, I would say the first thing is talk to your building management, because that's what I've been trying to do for 2 years and it hasn't worked.
Yeah, it hasn't worked in my building either.
Yeah, but you can begin a conversation. I think that's where everything starts. You must begin the conversation. So, and I think, yeah, I really do believe in the power of just just start from home. Start from how you operate. Think about how your life is and how that would change if you implemented this. And I think, I just think that if you can incorporate that into your daily life, scale that up to 7.8 million people or however many we have in Hong Kong now, and if everyone changed their habit, like just one bit, that could be huge. Of course, there's downstream issues with, at some point. So, you know, what if you have too much compost sitting at home? Sitting at your estate, what do you do with it? The downstreaming has to be thought out, of course, but I think we need to at least get people to start talking about it and about the possibility that they could do it in their own estates or in their own little, in Soho, you know, in a small community like that. We have to start the conversation.
Or on their roofs. I always have to think of one of my first interviews, can I bring that up, for Hashtag Impact Podcast, was with Paul Fabrega, that you probably both know, from Roof Club Republic. And at that point, I had no clue that something like this is even happening in Hong Kong, so this really opened my eyes. And coming back to that education part, you sharing your friends, waving their hands, not wanting the aubergine or the eggplant, I have to think of, you know, every individual like me. Look at me. Yeah, I recorded with Paul and we went up on their rooftop farm, and then I had seen for the first time how an eggplant actually grows, and you hear that in my recording. This is super embarrassing, but I'm gonna go on the record now because it's already on the record on Hashtag Impact Podcast. You hear me shouting out like in the recording, like when I spotted that eggplant, of course I knew how an eggplant looks because I picked it from a supermarket or a wet market, but I hadn't actually seen it on the plant. Yeah. And I think they are on an individual level. I find this really beautiful that you said that now. Like looking at me, but then looking at other people as well. There is a lot of actually resources here in Hong Kong with these urban farmers where you can get involved and where you can learn and get a bit intrigued as well about the topic and learn more. Like Paul really opened my eyes about a lot of things, not just
absolutely.
Not just the eggplant.
He's definitely a crusader for urban gardening, yes. Maybe the foremost one in Hong Kong. Yeah. But then this goes back to how we eat. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, do we cook enough? Do we really care about farmers markets? I mean, people tell you that they care. But, I mean, I see this all the time on Greek Queen, but like you, Janice, I'm in the end, it's very en vogue and it's very trendy, but
at the end of the day, we're city people that are, you know, especially in Hong Kong, where, like you say, it's so easy to just go downstairs. Even your 7-Eleven sells instant noodles. You know, they have hot water. You can cook there, like, quote-unquote cook.
Unbelievable.
It is crazy. Like, it is so easy. And, yeah, and we all work long hours, and we can get tired and go, okay, you know what, I really don't want to cook. And, yeah, it's hard. I think, it's going to sound like every other, you know, cliche, but it starts with education. It starts by telling people, look, it takes 6 minutes to boil an egg. Like, if you had to go downstairs and come up, it's actually probably like 8 minutes. So why don't you keep some eggs at home? Like, that's the easiest thing to cook. I mean, just really simple, small steps can if everyone implemented one small change, it could be, I seriously believe that it could be amazing. So it really is about, like, telling people it's real, like, don't make them change overnight. No one can change overnight. But we can do small things every day, I think. Like, and make it, I don't know, make it your resolution. Every month, at the beginning of the month, create a new thing that you can try and change and just see how it works in your life.
And what about when we go out? I mean, let's talk about restaurants. I mean, yes, putting composters, very important for chefs. But, you know, there's a lot of movements also with chefs doing different things. You know, ugly vegetable movement, produce-led movement. So people who are committed to sourcing locally, sourcing from the farmers to support them. There's now, in the world, there are food waste restaurants. In terms of how we buy, there's, of course, the bulk grocery and surplus supermarkets, which we don't have yet here, which I think could do well. But also in terms of chefs, things like the nose-to-tail movement.
Yeah, exactly. Nose-to-tail and then roots, shoots, and leaves, you know, every part of the plant. That, to be honest, I think that should be part of every chef's budgeting, because whatever you throw away, that's money. You know,
so we've got, like, Chef Nathan Green from Rhoda. He's a big proponent of the nose to tail.
Exactly.
Probably one of the leading figures in this movement here in terms of using everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, although he is, and he does try and he does use
the whole animal as much as possible.
But also, think about how this pig, for example, arrives in Hong Kong. I don't think it arrives as an entire pig with all the innards and everything. It arrives, if you look at, the classic example is like beef. It arrives not as an entire animal because it's too big and no one wants the head or the feet. So it arrives as fillets, you know, like people will only buy the rib, so therefore the importers are only buying this. So the waste actually starts before it even comes to Hong Kong. It comes from how we choose to buy, because we all love to eat ribeye steaks. So all that's coming into Hong Kong is ribeye steaks. How about the rest of the cow? You know, how about all the innards? It actually starts by how we choose to buy and eat the food.
Which is why we need more movements making it kind of trendy and educating people about why it's, you know, every part of the animal and the plant count.
Yeah, and you can see chefs in Hong Kong trying to do that to as much as possible. I mean, there are chefs who, plants are easy to, you know, to use top to root. You'll see people, for example, onion skins. You can actually keep all those and put it in stock. So at Amber, for example, which is one of Hong Kong's top foremost restaurants, they actually have a food waste bin for anything that can go into stock. So all the little tops and tails of carrots, because they're a fine dining restaurant, so obviously everything's very meticulous, but it doesn't mean that what they chop off goes to waste. If they peel a vegetable and that vegetable peel can go into stock, they'll put it in the stock bin. So then all that, everything from that little stock bin will then actually go into a stock. So actually, none of it then...
I do that at home.
Yeah, exactly.
Does, right?
Yeah, yeah. and it's
Cheaper.
It's cheaper. It helps you save money, and like, because you're like, well, you wouldn't want to buy in stock because like that's 90% water anyway. So you can actually make it all in your own kitchen by saving food scraps. So it's like a win-win-win. So yeah, like there are chefs definitely doing that on not just because of, you know, they want to save money, but actually they do save money. But also because it's just the logical thing to do, that, you know, we already have the waste, so we can use it. And it's what you want out of those vegetables is flavor, not how it looks or how, you know, it's already there. Why not use it?
And Daisy, do you think that there's a chance that we could get retailers in Hong Kong to commit to kind of not wasting every day? I mean, would you know, me either doing a ban like France or getting people to pay for their waste?
Mm-hmm. I think there is a huge capacity for it. Makes business sense, right? For businesses to not waste, because everything that they buy in and throw out is lost.
Why do they not care now?
Well,
they not do the math?
I think it's not so much that they don't do the math, it's more that they have difficulty in calculating or in trying to anticipate what customers want or how many customers will come. So this kind of anticipation and budgeting actually is very difficult for chefs, because we have so much choice, because consumers are fickle sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. we like today, we like Japanese, tomorrow we will go somewhere else, and we don't reserve. And I think this is something that could, even just for a very small action, before we change the culture, before we change mindset, we call the restaurants and we reserve.
With a credit card.
Commit,
I mean,
to your
people hate that.
Yeah, people hate it. But I mean, even prepaying for a meal seems so foreign to people. But you
here, especially,
yeah, like you prepay to go to a movie, you prepay to go to like a sports event. So why not, or a concert? Why not prepay? Why can't you commit to your meal?
Because so many people don't require prepaying,
well,
so
yeah.
you don't have to, right? But
yeah.
You're right.
So I think, yeah, bringing it back to the individual, these are things that we also can commit to that will help them, the restaurants, do better with their kind of budgeting and stock taking and also using up the waste. And then the other thing is also something to do with buffets, which Hong Kong people absolutely adore.
Mm.
Right? They love the idea that you pay a bit.
It's
all you can eat. It's all you can eat. It's unlimited. It's excessive. And the funny thing is, like, since when do we eat sushi with, you know, steak, you know? Since when do we do these kind of pairings anyway? So it's this kind of excessive culture that is very popular, and which also creates a lot of waste. So for even all the hotels and participating restaurants that commit to donating all the surpluses from buffets, everything that's left the kitchen cannot be donated because of food safety reasons. And so imagine when, as consumers, we expect diversity, we expect choice, we expect not just choice but beautifully laid out choices, then this contributes to a very excessive food consumer culture. What we are trying to do, I'm saying no also for Janice, but for all of us, I think what we're trying to do is that, yes, trend is extremely important and it has a power because it reaches a large amount of people, but what we want to do is to push for this trend to become not just a lifestyle, becomes a way of life. So we change the way we consume, we change the way we think about food, we change the way we eat, including cooking, but we also change the way we go to restaurants. I mean, that's the fundamental change that will eventually help.
Right, because we have to be realistic. Hong Kongers do eat out a lot.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
We need to figure out solutions for going out to eat. And I think, wow, I like the idea of prepaying. That's a good point, that people don't connect to food waste a lot.
Yeah.
So before we wrap up, because, I mean, we could talk for hours more, Daisy, can you tell us a little bit about this incredible... So first of all, congratulations.
You
just won the Fulbright, which is one of the best, most important awards in the world. So congratulations. Like, wow, what an amazing honor. Can you tell us what you're going to do with this?
So this is really exciting. I am really, really
Well, it's very... most people can never get there. So wow.
So with the Fulbright Senior Research Award, I'll be taking a part of my research to MIT in September. And what I'll be doing in MIT is to develop an online platform that makes it easier for people to help pick up surplus food. And I'm interested in this because I know volunteer organization is very labor intensive, so it creates a lot of work for NGOs. The reporting is also very labor intensive. The data doesn't really get collected in a systematic way, so for researchers like myself, it's very difficult to get the data. So in view of that, what we're trying to develop is to have an online platform that shares real-time information to facilitate pickup. So registered volunteers will be able to pick up the food and help the NGOs deliver it to either the beneficiary's point or at least a central collection point so that it can be easily dealt with. Part of the nature of surplus food is also interesting is because they all become available at the same time over a very large geographical space, like all of Hong Kong.
What do you mean by that? It all becomes available at the same time.
So imagine a bakery, or a lot of bakeries in Hong Kong are willing to donate bread, but imagine 200, 300 outlets, and they all close at 9 o'clock. So all the surplus food becomes available.
Oh, I see. So it's all at the same time, and it's
all
over the city. I see.
Right. So something like this would make it easier for people to pick up and drop off the surplus food. And one of the things I think I'm interested in is also asking people to care, but also making it easier for them to care.
You've got to make things easy. I mean, I think if there's anything we've learned on this journey is people can only adapt their lifestyle. I mean, you've always got the eco warriors, but the average person has their own concerns every day, and you've got to make things a little easier, right?
Yeah. So I think this is going to test out how this platform is going to make things easier for people and maybe get more people involved.
Is this for consumers? Is it to match businesses with consumers or businesses with organizations or NGOs?
It would be individual volunteers who could be using the system. It would be via the NGO who will be matching the surplus food with the beneficiaries, and it will be with the donors, the people who are willing to donate the food. So I'm hoping that this would be launched in January next year.
That's very exciting. Well, we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Before we close off, I do want to take a moment to mention, so our third panelist today was going to be Liz Thomas, co-founder of Food Savior. Now, Food Savior is an interesting beast because it's a platform that operates in the for-profit space. And so what the plan is there, and they were operational, they're now just rejigging a few things, but they launched last year, and what they do is they get restaurants at the end of the day to sell their food and get it delivered to consumers at half price. So this is addressing the food waste, the surplus food, and the fact that people may want discounts. So this is in the for-profit space, which I think it's a good model because I think that people, you know, do want cheaper food.
Yeah.
And restaurants.
In a way, it makes it more accessible to people because maybe they can't afford it at full price. So, and if it's discounted, they can afford, afford food that's just a few hours older.
Absolutely. So we hope Liz and her team are gonna get that back live up again because it's certainly a great initiative, right? I mean, it's kind of parallel to what you're doing, but if we could get more in the for-profit space. And I think it's good to have for-profit initiatives, kind of like a Hong Kong Recycles, for this space because you need all the actors.
Financial
certainly.
Sustainability is just as important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's definitely part. So, wow, another incredible discussion.
I love so much. Every time I'm like blown away. I love it. And also from you, Sonali. Can I just say that? Because you're always so modest. And like I learn so much from you every time. You're doing so amazing research. And from you as well, Janice, Daisy. So excited for what's ahead.
for all of your projects.
Thank you, Regina. We're so, thanks for helping me go on this journey. Without you, I would never have started. So I'm incredibly grateful. And if you're listening, everyone, I think, you know, cook more and make sure that you support local farmers. And when you eat out, support chefs that really care about sustainability.
Make good on your reservations.
Oh, yeah. That is such a good one. I have to say, I would not have connected that with food waste. I love it. I also want to take a second to thank Garage Society Shengwan. We're in their brand new digs in Shengwan. Because they just moved offices, and they very, very kindly donate the space to this podcast in the spirit of a good cause. So thank you, Garage. Thank you, Hey You and James and the whole team. We're super grateful, as always, for all the support. And everyone listening, thank you so much. If you weren't able to listen or you only got half of it, it's going to be, the link is live forever. So please tune in. And see you next time. We'll be announcing soon what the next episode will be about. But signing off.